Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Let's say hello to our friend Mike McFarland, former Royals catcher and all-around good guy. What's up, Mac? How are you?
Is everything all right there at the station? Everything good?
You know,
we're on time for the first time in like 10 years since we've been doing this. I'm just wondering if we're running out of material or
here's the deal. We stopped listening to Jake and took things in our own hands, and so we're on time now.
With you, oh, so. Hell no. That Jake's blood pressure is the calmest I think it's ever been today.
Yep, usually Jake is like telling us not to break. Just take the segment longer. Keep going, guys. Yeah. Don't break.
Keep going.
You must have had Jeff Penner on to do the weather today because you're on time. That's what it is.
You would think, but it was Gary, and he was all in. We've just
all it took was a global pandemic to get us on the clock. So
there you go. Everything is right in the world around here, at least, not everywhere else. But good.
It's a moist one.
Sun is out.
All right, Mac, let's get into some baseball news. And I read from the story by Jeff Passan at ESPN.com. Hundreds of minor league baseball players were cut Thursday, and hundreds more are expected to lose their jobs as the sport grapples with near certainty that the minor league season will be canceled. Team officials said a vast majority of the players likely would have been released toward the end of spring training, even if baseball hadn't been halted by the pandemic, but the cuts, which could wind up numbering more than 1,000, nevertheless reverberated around the game, and released players expressed fear that their careers would be over, and those whose teams hadn't yet made cuts prepared for a tenuous next few days. I mean, you've been through it. You've been through the minor leagues, and you spent so much time in the majors, you understand what it's like to have to make that journey to get to the peak of your career. And just curious what your reaction is to what's happening right now with all the minor leaguers.
Well, they can spin it any way they want. It's kind of the culling of the herd, I guess you could say. A very sad day for, you know, kids that signed out of high school that were anticipating time to develop. Get better. They're putting that spin that, yeah, probably a lot of these kids would have been released come June when the draft came around at the end of spring training. I think it's an absolute no-brainer that the minor leagues are going to be canceled this year, and how and what they do moving forward with instructional league, how they get that going. What are they going to do with these so-called taxi squads to get them action, everything else? I think you're seeing the start of minor league baseball and the face of it completely changing, and it's really going to have an effect on some of these small towns that depend and rely on, you know, workers working the ballpark and the games and the vendors, and it just covers the whole areas of those local economies that are being hammered right now from the pandemic, and it's going to only get worse now that that minor league season is going to be canceled, and you're going to see some teams going under. I saw a story, I think Passan, like you said, it talked about some guy that put out another mortgage on his house and doing everything he can to possibly hold on to his minor league team. I just don't think people in the real world understand the small towns that have these minor league teams, how special and how much pride they take in that in the first place, but how much the economy is going to be affected because people not taking vacations to go see these small town minor league cities anymore. It's going to have a vast impact on these smaller communities.
So, Mac, I've been thinking about this this situation because it does seem like in a lot of sports right now, leagues are trying to figure out the best way to develop young talent, right? Like the NBA has started to kind of, you know, they've invested more in the NBDL, which is kind of like their minor league, but they've always had that free minor league system of college basketball, and so is the NFL. as you know, I watch a lot of global soccer, and most teams have their own academy systems and B teams that they bring guys up through on their own. But one of the things that happens in the world of soccer is there are so many leagues all over the world that guys that maybe aren't even playing in the quote-unquote best league still get paid a lot of money. Even in basketball, like guys that, you know, there's a lot of guys that, you know, Jacob Pullen from K-State or guys from KU that maybe not quite good enough to play in the NBA or star in the NBA, but they can go make upwards of millions of dollars a year playing in other countries in the world. Whereas in baseball, it's like, man, if you're a 4A player, you're playing in the minor leagues and you're not making any real money. And it's kind of crazy to me that the only players in baseball that can make real money are the ones in the major leagues. I guess you can go to Japan and make some decent money, but that's about it. Do you think there's any way that ever changes? Because I feel like if you're that good of a if you're a 4A baseball player, you're a freaking good baseball player. You're the kind of baseball player that I would pay money to go watch, yet they make nothing. Is there any way to change, or should that change at all as we get through this situation where guys that are good enough to be pro ball players could actually make decent money?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, the NFL, basically, the college is their ranks, especially with the pro-style systems that are going in at the, you know, the Power Five conferences and all over football. They're much better, much more ready to step in and learn. It's just at a higher speed. Basketball, China, Greece, the European League, soccer academies all over the place. Those other major sports do a much better job of keeping players in their system to find those diamonds in the rough that finally figure it out and have a chance to go. Before, you know, you get to AAA, you're starting to make some decent money. You're making some very good money in a relatively short amount of time. But when you're talking short season A, first year, all the way up till you're a six-year free agent in the minor league, you're not making squat. You know, I was living with five guys in a two-bedroom apartment, you know, no post-game spreads or anything like that in the minor leagues, but until you get to the higher levels. But it is one of those things that's a rite of passage that you got to understand that you're going to put as the majority of your money towards rent and feeding yourself. And that's not to mention players that have wives and children that aren't making anything. Trying to find a job and working your tail off and train at the same time during the off season, it is a hard, hard life. And I'm still a huge proponent of going to college for at least 3 years to at least get some semblance of a background that you can make it in the real world after your playing career is gone. The toughest part, Nate, is, you know, these baseball players that just keep hanging on. And I love the game so much, I'm going to go until, you know, the quote, rip the jersey off my back, and then you're done. For those kids that signed out of high school for, you know, $50,000, they buy a truck right off the bat, and then what? Then you're just scraping by. And your future gets very tough unless you're lucky enough to be, you know, identified as a potential coach in the future for an organization. But, you know, it's just a very tough decision coming out of high school for some of these kids. They're not particularly good in school, don't particularly care, but they can throw hard or hit the crap out of a ball that sign. And basically, where does their future go after that, even, you know, with the, okay, we'll pay for your schooling after this. You know, how many of those kids actually take the organization up on that, or they just go get a menial job? So I do think that the other sports do a much better job of taking care of the younger players that you know, trying to develop them and give them a chance and learn some other life skills. It's awfully hard. So, you know, unless there's a lot of zeros behind a number for these high school kids, you're missing out on, one, three of the funnest years of your life going to college, and two, developing a little bit higher so you can start in something other than rookie league where you're making $400 or $500 a month.
We have Mike McFarlane on the line. Mac, I want to switch gears here and talk to you about an E60 special that's going to be on ESPN tonight, and it's going to be very powerful. And I've seen a couple of previews and watched a little bit of it, but I think it's going to be important for a number of reasons for people to watch it. It's Imperfect, the Roy Halladay story. And the description says it goes beyond his on-field accomplishments to reveal there was another side to him, a deeply imperfect side that the public never saw, including a years-long battle with mental health issues and addiction. The program debuts tonight at 6 o'clock on ESPN, airing on the 10th anniversary of the perfect game that he pitched while a member of the Philadelphia Phillies back on May 29th, 2010, against the Marlins. I looked it up, and you had 6 at-bats against Roy Halladay. You did get a hit, so you were 1-for-6 against Roy Halladay. But clearly one of the best pitchers of his era, and I'm very interested in watching this tonight. And they said they're going to talk to all of his family, and you're going to see a lot of footage that hasn't been seen before. So just curious if you're going to watch this and how you remember Roy Halladay, not only facing him but watching him as such a dominant pitcher for so long.
Well, this is where ESPN gets it right. I can't stand the screaming and hollering and back and forth shows that they have. But when they do these ESPN 60s or the 30 for 30s, they are outstanding. I absolutely love the Alex Smith story, watching him in his rehab, and I am absolutely watching this one tonight as well. The thing that people are going to find that pulling the curtain back a little bit on the intense pressure being a major league player in some of those people that do have the addictive type of personalities, you know, the alphas that are just constantly working and overworking, and the perfectionists that made them the ball players and athletes that they were, also have some downsides to it. I faced Roy when he was with the Blue Jays, and it was before he changed his arm slot and just became, as you said, one of the most dominant pitchers in the game. He was just absolutely filthy. But, you know, the perfection-driven side of a professional athlete, it's good that you're starting to hear some of these players that are still playing now talk about the mental issues that you have. And, you know, sometimes it's better to be one of those guys that just flies under the radar, that aren't the superstars that are forced to do whatever it takes to keep them at that elite level, whether it's the, let's go through the 90 steroids, doing what they have to do to be the best or continue to be the best as their body starts to fail them. And, the drug addiction that you talk about with the LA Angels pitcher that had some issues. There's more of that going on than you know. I think the teams are starting to realize that and doing a better job of getting some professional help in there with the team shrinks, that are there to help and kind of talk it through. And you'll see some cases where someone's going on the injured list for specific injuries that you're going, okay, I really don't think that's the injury. Maybe there's something behind that. But it's good that the organizations are starting to come out, and stories like this about some of these outstanding athletes and ball players in all phases of sports that are seeking help finally, and it's okay. You know, back in the caveman years when I played, any sign of weakness was not allowed. I mean, you had to go home and do what you needed to do to clear your head and get ready for the next day. Playing every single day, even if you are a pitcher, you're still at the ballpark, and I can only imagine if you have a bad start, sitting there for the next 4 days chomping at the bit to go out and play again. But for an everyday player, we sometimes had that luxury of being able to forget about it because you got 4 at-bats coming tonight, and it helps a little bit in that regard. So I think it's good that this is coming out. I'm looking forward to it just from, okay, it's just more information from a Hall of Fame player that you're not the only one if you have these issues. And nowadays, it is okay to seek help, and don't worry so much about your persona. I know that he was you know, just reading the article on ESPN that he was embarrassed to go to rehab and ask for help, and, you know, the stigma of being an athlete, those things, how are they going to view me now? Well, I think it's a lot more lenient, especially in the clubhouse. A tight-knit group that the players care more about you, but also understand the problems that are associated with that. And going out and performing on any given night, there is a absolute ton of pressure that people don't realize to try and stay at the top, especially as you get older.
And that's why I think it's so important for people to watch this. I mean, you're so right, and this is. It is going to be difficult to watch. It's the first time since his death that his wife is going to speak on camera about his struggles with pain and addiction, and she said that she didn't want the end of the story to be, you know, he was addicted to drugs and he obviously crashed his plane. But she said she wants people to know about his battles with addiction, with depression, with anxiety. And how difficult it was. She said he had no clue who he was without baseball. And obviously that's something that a lot of athletes deal with once they're done playing, what their identity is. And if we could see someone he's a Hall of Famer, at the peak of his career, he was one of the most dominant pitchers for a decade, that someone that has all that success and all has reached the pinnacle of his career, but still has all of these troubles dealing with depression and addiction and anxiety. I mean, it could hit anyone. It could affect anyone. I think that's an important message from tonight. And you've seen, like you said, you've seen that. We don't get to see behind the curtain like you have. But I think this is going to be a very interesting watch for any baseball fan or anyone that has dealt with any of those problems or knows someone that's dealt with those problems.
Oh, yeah, exactly right. And if it's okay for a superstar athlete to feel this way, well, then you don't feel so different and so isolated, and it is okay to go out and reach for help. And it is hard. And speaking from experience, it is very tough. Once you get done competing on a nightly basis and being around your boys and that band of brotherhood, so to speak, from an athletic standpoint, of going to the park and being around your guys for 8 straight months and then coming home, you know, and now I'm not getting ready for spring training. You still have to realize you're a husband, you're a father. There are things that you can do out there, you know, like Roy with some of the foundations, and especially what his wife is doing now, I think shows you how extremely strong she is, that she's coming out and helping to inform about the situation. There's a lot of good things that are going to come out of us this show tonight, and like I said, really looking forward to it.
Yeah, you know, it's something I think the way that that my wife Kelly taught me to look at it, I used to probably have some of those same thoughts that we've been talking about here about the, you know, you don't want to show that sign of weakness. She works physical therapy and rehabbing parts of the body that are injured, and the brain is no different. You know, therapy is to help, you know, help heal something that has gone through something that's damaged it. And we can all use therapy, by the way. You don't have to have a torn ACL to be able to use therapy sometimes. You know, you might just have a back that aches or certain parts of your body that are sore, and things you can do to improve the way your body functions and works. And we can all use therapy on our minds, to be honest with you. We can all strengthen our brains and make ourselves healthier as human beings. I do think that it's good that we get to the point where we look at it that way. You go do therapy on your knee, people don't say to you, well, you're not tough enough. You know, you're actually trying to make your knee better. That's why you're doing it. It's the same thing with mental health and therapy. And hopefully, Mac, as you said, we're at a point now where people look at it the same way that you look at doing rehab on any other part of your body.
Oh, I think you're exactly right, Nate. And you're seeing the organizations being more proactive, especially in the minor league, with the pressures that are associated with the quote, making it part and still being viable, and the competitiveness of trying to move up each and every year to a different level. I think the organizations have done a great job of trying to institute changes at that level that the coaches and managers and in the minor league level are now more aware of it and making sure they're keeping tabs on the mental health. I mean, look, common sense says a mentally strong and a mentally healthy ball player is going to be a better ball player. And it just, you know, it too much of the business side and performance side that drives these players to seek, you know, something that can help you to get that extra edge and stay over the top and be competitive night in and night out. Some of those things are the problems that are being addressed on a more consistent basis. And like I said, at the major league level, you know, you used to call them quacks and everything else coming in. That was the old days. Now it's a lot more intense with the ability to read Twitter pages and vile things that are on the internet about you. It's an awfully tougher league to play in right now than it was when I was playing, that's for sure. Cell phones were just coming out, and that was more for emergencies or talk to your wife after the game. But nowadays, it's just you're connected to everything that could possibly be mean and mean-spirited in the world out there, that if you read those things, and crying out loud, it'll just eat you up from the inside.
And again, tonight, the documentary on ESPN, the E60 documentary, Imperfect, the Roy Halladay story, premieres at 6 o'clock. And, Mac, before we run out of time, and obviously this is going to be about more than what he did on the field, but Roy Halladay, as we've mentioned a couple of times, was one of the most dominant pitchers of his era. And so I want to ask you about that. From 2001 to 2011, posted a 2.98 ERA in over 2,300 innings, 8 All-Star teams, 2 Cy Young Awards. He threw the perfect game, and this is the 10th anniversary tonight of that perfect game, but also a freaking no-hitter in the postseason in the NLDS against the Cincinnati Reds. What was it about Roy Halladay that separated him? What made him a Hall of Fame pitcher?
Well, again, I get back to just the adjustment that he found and he made. I think he got sent down to Single A to try and get his mind clear and everything else, and then come back and be a Hall of Fame pitcher after making a few adjustments. He dropped his arm slot a little bit, got a little better sweep and on his breaking ball and a better cut on his fastball. But you talk about those guys and the bulldog mentality that when they were on the mound, it was a fist fight. And they'd rather punch you than say hello to you. Roger Clemens, you know, Saberhagen, David Cone, those type of guys that just had a different... When you were up at bat and you're facing those type of pitchers, Dave Stewart, you know, just the difference in the look. You look him in the face and all you see is determination. I mean, there were other pitchers that would go out there, and you'd look and say, all right, I got a chance. Some nights you'd go out there, you know the pitcher had it going on the mound. You would step into the box, and you were fighting to put the barrel on the ball for 4 straight at-bats. They just had that I-will-not-be-beat mentality, and you can watch Roy and some of his highlights and just see that determination and focus and just the ability to get the job done in crucial situations. A perfect game, a no-hitter in the playoffs, I mean, that's just unbelievable, at the, and especially in the playoffs against one of the best teams in the league, obviously, because they made the playoffs. Just an amazing career for Roy.
Did you know that Jake has been described as the kind of producer that would rather punch you in the face than say hello to you?
Yeah.
Is that why he's successful?
He'll give you that glare. You guys know that glare he gives you from behind the mirror.
Well, if you're an intern,
that's right.
Shape up.
And that's right.
And yeah, God forbid you're an intern for Jake, because it's you'd rather be going through Navy SEAL training than to be an intern for Jake.
That's true.
You're
not exaggerating.
Actually,
at all,
Mac,
to be honest.
I keep a bell in here, and interns, when when they quit, they have to ring the bell when they leave.
They got to ring the bell or tap out, one or the other.
Who is, of all the guys, because you rattled off some names, of all the guys that you caught for, who was the one guy that was like that on the day that he pitched that you didn't even want to be around him? He would, like you said, rather punch someone in the mouth Then talk to him. Who was the most intense guy on their day to pitch that you ever caught for?
Clemens, without question. You didn't speak to him. You didn't get near him. I didn't talk to him warming up in the bullpen. On the way back in, after he warmed up, we would talk about what felt good and what he was looking to do. Obviously, he would, we would go in to talk about the hitters, and he'd stand up after the first hitter, and he goes, "If I shake, that was the wrong sign." I said, "All right, bud, let's go." And after that, it was, you know, the other 4 days, he was a workaholic and did all of those things. But when he was on the mound, you were hoping that you were sticking the right finger down, because when he got in a flow and he had everything working, it didn't matter what finger you stuck down for a sign. He was throwing it, and he would definitely execute it. But as far as just meanness and things like that, he was a mean SOB when he was on the mound, for sure.
Mike McFarland has been our guest. Mac, hope you and your family have a great weekend. Thanks for the time, man.
Enjoy the sun, boys. We'll see you.
We'll do that. That's Mike McFarland. Love talking to Mac. And that's going to be a very interesting, I think it's a very, I think it's a must watch to check out the E60 documentary on Roy Halladay tonight that premieres at 6 o'clock on ESPN. Be right back after this with James Krause on Sports Radio 810 WHB.